Welcome to the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
We're waiting on Coast Guard clearance on this tug and barge right now.
The sound of directing traffic for two key drivers of the South Florida economy, trade and tourism.
Pilot, all the personnel, and now they're dragging their feet.
Two industries that have grown in uncertain terms over the past few years. This is inside the Harbor Master Tower at Port Everglades, which saw a drop in the number of cruise passengers it hosted last year. But Port Miami set a record with 4 million cruise passengers. Both expect their tourism and trade businesses to pick up this year, and both are expanding to compete for it. We visited with both port directors ahead of the new year, beginning on Dodge Island, home of Port Miami's director, Bill Johnson.
In 2014, Port Miami will hit right at the 5 million cruise passenger mark, which is a phenomenal number. No port in the world other than Miami has ever hit the 4 million mark.
Is the capacity for the passenger growth, the infrastructure, ready to go, ready to handle that kind of headcount?
We've been working on that. The port is in the process of finishing up right at $2 billion of smart infrastructure. Most of this is geared towards helping us maintain and grow market share on the container side. On the cruise side, we hope to be, in 2014, selecting the development team to come in to finance, design, construct what would be the world's largest mega cruise facility. And we hope to have that underway by the latter part of 2014. That would provide Port Miami a 33% increase in cruise capacity.
Tell me a little bit more about where the planning will be for this mega cruise expansion a year from now.
But starting this February, the port will receive Norwegian Cruise Line. That's NCL, Norwegian Cruise Line's newest ship. It comes to our port in February of 14. This is the Breakaway, and it will be their newest and their largest vessel. It will sail year-round from Port Miami starting, as I said, in January of 14. But the exciting news is, in the fall of 2015, this will be the Getaway Plus. And the Getaway Plus, again, will sell year-round from Miami starting in the fall of 15, and it's under a three-year contract, that particular ship. In 2014, we're going to be kicking off a series of initiatives and projects with the private sector. We love public-private partnerships here at Port Miami. And so we're looking for our new mega cruise facility. It could possibly be something that we work with in terms of funding from the EB-5 federal program. There's other things that we're looking at in terms of public-private partnerships. But, yes, we're looking for private sector investment, and it makes a lot of sense for the private sector.
The EB-5 program allows foreigners to invest somewhere to the tune of $500,000 to $1 million in order to secure essentially a visa for the United States.
Yes, and it's worked well in some instances. It hasn't quite worked as anticipated in others. So, you know, we're exploring this with our eyes wide open.
Two of the perhaps most visible signs of expansion for Port of Miami, the tunnel and the new Super Panamax gentry cranes.
Well, cargo's been difficult for most of us in most ports of the United States. The U.S. economy is still, we're on a slow rebound, and that has really hindered the kind of growth we'd like to see in the container business here in the United States. We're anticipating at Port Miami, and we're hoping that by the end of this decade, by 2020, Port Miami will literally double the amount of cargo activity. Our largest trading partner for the last 7-8 years has been China. Every year, China, as a single country, represents 18-20% of our business.
That's Port Miami business?
Port Miami. 18-20% of our business with one country is China. China has slowed a little. It's important to understand this. During the downturn of 2008, 2009, 2010, some of the strongest economies of the world were to the south. It was, in fact, or it has been, Brazil and Colombia and Peru and Chile. These economies have stayed relatively strong, even though the growth rate and the increase of economic increase in those countries is not what it was, you know, approaching double digit. It's still relatively healthy compared to Europe or compared to the U.S. Underway right now is the deep dredge. Port Miami will be the only port on the east coast of America come summer of 15, in advance of Panama Canal. We will open at 50 feet a good 6 months before the Panama Canal improvements are finished. So Panama, by late 2015, will be at 50 feet. By July of the same year, July of 15, Miami will be at 50 feet also, making us the only port south of Norfolk, Virginia, at 50 feet of water. So what do you got here? You got 50 feet of water. You're able to bring in the big super post-Panamax ships. You got the big super post-Panamax cranes. Wow. That's a huge cost savings. And ultimately, that should result, if you will, and trickle down to the store shelf for the consumer, because a big ship like the super post-Panamax coming to Miami in 2015 represent about a 30% cost reduction. Miami is geographically blessed. We are the first port of entry coming into the United States of America from the Panama Canal.
Do you anticipate stealing market share, grabbing that business from those other East Coast ports?
It's interesting to note that today, as we do this interview, 60% of what we consume in Florida, that's 60% of what Floridians consume and our visitors consume, comes from a port outside our state. That's product coming through either the port of Los Angeles, the port of Long Beach, next to Los Angeles, or the port of Savannah. They have devoured the state of Florida, and we intend, at least Port Miami, intends to recapture that lost business, that market share. And that's worth billions and billions and billions to the economy of our state, and it represents the opportunity to create hundreds of thousands of new high-paying jobs in our state.
How could that impact, for instance, the generally higher cost of living that South Florida has compared to some other places in the country?
It should lower it. Today, let's put it this way. Let's look at your perishables. Most of the fruit and vegetable on your dinner table tonight at home are coming to you from a port outside Florida. Most perishables come into America either through the port of Wilmington, Philadelphia, or Southern California. That's outrageous. That's absolutely outrageous. That's unacceptable. Because you're moving the product from Guatemala or from Chile or Peru. All those products move by water all the way up to Wilmington or Philadelphia. Then they're offloaded onto a truck, and then they're trucked on the highway system south to Florida, to Winn-Dixie and Publix, and you know, into Whole Foods. That's crazy. And today, I'm proud to say, it started last month. We have a pilot program, the first in our history. And so Port Miami and now Port Everglades is working on this as well. About a month ago, we received our first Peruvian grapes brought into Miami. And so that's a win for all of us. That's a win for the consumer, okay, because they're getting a better product, hopefully at a lower cost. And it's a win-win for Florida, creating jobs in our state.
I've driven about 35 miles north now of Port Miami to visit the other big port in South Florida, Port Everglades in Fort Lauderdale. I'm now waiting in line to go through the security here. There are several fuel trucks and cargo trucks with those 20-foot containers off to my right going through their specially designated lane. I'm behind a taxi cab, presumably that's going to perhaps service some cruise passengers on their way for a getaway or coming to pick somebody up, coming back from a trip through the Caribbean, for instance. Port Everglades does a significant cruise business, as does Port Miami. The port here in Fort Lauderdale expects to greet about 4 million cruise passengers this year. It also has a significant trade function as well. Today, a lot of gasoline, a lot of jet fuel, asphalt, other building materials all comes through the port here in Fort Lauderdale. Got to get out my ID here to get through security. Peruvian grapes started coming through here in a pilot program that was designed to expand the port trade category to some agriculture products. Go through security here at the port. Hi there, how are you?
How are you going today?
I've got a meeting at administration with the port director.
No weapon in the vehicle, right?
What's that?
No firearm in the vehicle.
No, sir.
All right, have a go.
Okay, thank you. All right, we've got the special parking designations that I need now. Back to the Peruvian grapes here. It may not sound like a big opportunity, but usually produce that we find in the stores here in South Florida wind up coming into the United States through ports that are in the mid-Atlantic and Northeast and then brought down to South Florida. The reason why is concerns about invasive species and pests being stowaways on that produce if brought in directly into our ecosystem down here. the Peruvian grapes pilot program with the State Department of Agriculture, Port Miami, and Port Everglades has as a goal to expand the port trade categories for agriculture products. Let's go ahead and pull into one of the visitor parking spaces here at the administration building. Go talk to the director.
Steve Cernak, Chief Executive, Port Director, Port Everglades.
Steve, what does the new opportunity of Peruvian grapes present for Port Everglades?
It provides the opportunity of, one, providing the opportunity to get goods to market sooner at a higher quality for the consumers and also at a lower cost.
For the port and the international trade business that you've experienced over the past several years and the slow growth of that business, how important is this new product category for 2014?
I think it opens up a new marketplace for us, and it allows us to further develop that line of business. It will lead to better quality consumer goods. At the same time, it will allow us to establish relationships and to further develop trade within those countries.
What kind of investments has this opportunity required on the part of the port?
We have the facilities in place today to handle the goods, so there was no additional investments required.
I know a much larger investment is looked at over the next several years, the expansion of the port, the dredging of the port, the deepening of the port to accept those super post-Panamax ships that are expected to come through Panama in years ahead. Port Everglades is a few years behind the expansion project in Port Miami. What's 2014 hold for the expansion of Port Everglades?
We are advancing our plans forward. Part of that, the first phase of that, was the expansion of the Southport turning notch, and that is moving forward. The permits are getting put into place, and we'll have to do the environmental remediation, but we will be moving that project forward on a fast track to put ourselves in the position so that we're still on target to get to a deepened channel by the end of 2017 or shortly thereafter.
How do you assess the process that it has taken Port Everglades to get to this point? There has been significant delays that you've experienced for various reasons and working through various agencies, most notably, of course, the legislative agency in Washington, D.C.
How much time do you have for this interview? all kidding aside, any time a project of this magnitude that's this important to the regional and nation's economy takes 17 years to study, we have a problem. I will say that the federal legislative delegation has actually been very, very supportive. The business community in Fort Lauderdale, very supportive. The state delegation, the governor, everybody's been very supportive. It's just that the process that we've had to go through with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has been frustrating at best. We continue to work the issues. This project has moved a lot farther than it ever had before in the prior 17 years. So, we're going to continue to push and get to where we need to be. It's to support vessels that will be coming through the Panama Canal. I have to tell you that those vessels currently call at Port Everglades today, albeit light-loaded, and that's predominantly on the north-south trade. So we already have the business need for the deepening today.
Has the expansion project of Port Everglades, do you think, fallen victim to some degree of competition amongst ports and the legislators that represent those particular areas?
No, not totally. I mean, there may be we're in a competitive environment, and that's true. But I wouldn't lay the blame solely on that. I would say it's more of an issue of funding, and how funding is distributed in this country, and the nature in which that has to play itself out in the forum in Washington, D.C. I want to go back to the whole thing about competition, and I'm going to specifically talk about Miami and Port Everglades. We complement each other. We service different customers. If Port Everglades were to cease to operate, Miami could not take all of the cargo that we handle. They just do not have the physical space to do so. Conversely, if the same was true and we had to take it on, we would not be able to handle all the cargo that comes through the ports. we complement each other. If someone who lives in South Florida takes a flight somewhere, the fuel that's fueling that plane came from Port Everglades. You go to the gas pumps, the fuel came through Port Everglades. So we serve a critical need, and I think that's something that really, you know, is off everybody's radar screen. And we, in a lot of ways, we complement, you know, what Miami does in supporting the region.
Talk to us about the growth opportunities you're seeing on the cruise side as the cruise business continues to expand nationally.
We're actively looking to identify a way to expand our cruise operations, looking at all our facilities and see if there's a way that we can add an additional berth, for example, or lengthen an existing berth in some manner to handle the larger ships, because like cargo ships are getting larger, we're going to start to see larger cruise ships too as the population that would take a cruise expands. They're going to have to support that in some way, and I see that in a large part being handled through larger vessels.
Where is that expansion planning? Is it just in the concept idea phase?
It's in the concept idea. We're updating our master plan, which we do on every 5 years, and we're in that process right now. The dilemma we face with cruise is that it's a weekend business predominantly. The way this country works, and we take a vacation, if you're going to go on your vacation, you're going to work on Friday, and then Saturday your vacation starts, and you're going to get the benefit of the next week off. And so when you're doing that, we have our peak demand on the weekend. There certainly is capacity for shorter duration cruises, for example, like 3 and 4 day cruises, which sort of go around the weekend. And, you know, if somebody wants to have a different experience, or midweek cruises, that's the challenge. I mean, with the existing infrastructure, we have growth capacity. But because of the demand on the weekend, that's why we're evaluating a way to create an additional berth.
That's Steve Cernak, director at Port Everglades in Fort Lauderdale. We have a live web chat undergoing right now at WLRN.org, and it includes a picture from inside that Harbor Master Tower at Port Everglades in Fort Lauderdale. Still to come on the Sunshine Economy, changing the words, but it's the same tune selling cars. Lots of them.
When you need a car,
Tucker Van, we
need a car,
oh, Rudy.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. We're staring at the sun, the year ahead for South Florida. Thanks for listening. Are you behind the wheel of a new car or truck? Is one sitting in the driveway, maybe the parking lot here today? Well, 15.6 million new cars and trucks were sold nationwide last year, the biggest year for auto sales in the past 6 years. 300,000 of those cars and trucks were sold by AutoNation, the company behind more than 250 auto dealers across 15 states headquartered in the Sunshine Economy in Fort Lauderdale. Mike Jackson is the chairman and CEO of AutoNation, and he joins us now on the program. Mike, Happy New Year, and welcome to the Sunshine Economy.
Tom, Happy New Year to you.
Heck of a year for AutoNation and your stakeholders. 300,000 cars and trucks sold last year. Can you keep up that kind of pace?
Well, we've had 4 years of double-digit growth for AutoNation, with the industry averaging right around high nines. During that period of time, you put that all together, you already called out the number, 15,600,000 for last year. I think the underlying fundamentals are still strong and will support sales breaking through 16 million next year, but the rate of growth is definitely going to slow, something to like 3-4%, because we're now approaching trend rate, you know, 16 million. If you look at the scrappage rate, household formation, replacement rate, the number you get to is right around 16 million. And why we have pent-up demand and great financing and great new products, you can't grow those proverbial trees to the sky. At a certain point, you hit the trend rate. And this year, 2014, that's what's going to happen. But listen, I'll take $16 million. It's a great number.
It's a number that we haven't seen since prior to the Great Recession and, of course, the housing bust and a lot of the financial destruction that happened in 2008 and 2009. The other big statistic out there for a long time has been the average age of automobiles on U.S. roads, 11 years plus in some cases. Is that the pent-up demand that you're seeing fulfilled?
It is, indeed. You know, in the financial crisis, we couldn't get customers financed. And then we had the Great Recession. So people stopped buying cars and trucks in the end of 2008. You can mark your calendar, September 15th, 2008, bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, a day that will live in economic infamy, right through 2010. So that pushed out the average age to 11.3 years, a number that America's never been at before. And so people need to do something. And they come in, they like what they see in the new products. Ironically, we have great financing available today because during the Great Recession, everybody kept making their car payment.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the financing because at least on the mortgage side for residential real estate, record low interest rates, same for car loans. But for homes, it's only, you know, for well-qualified borrowers. That's the case in any economic expansion, certainly. But talk to us about the quality of borrowers that AutoNation has seen.
Well, we have the full spectrum of lending available today. So we had the great crash in 08, 09. Credit wasn't available. Eventually, the banks wanted to go back to lending. They looked around to where to lend, and lo and behold, people were paying for the cars before they paid for their mortgage or their children's education. So they knew it was safe to come back into auto lending. And so prime healed first, then near prime, then subprime, then leasing. So today we have the full spectrum of credit readily available and at very attractive rates. And while I know the Federal Reserve has started their taper process, what they have said is that short-term rates will stay low for a very long time. And that's the world we live in automotive, both for funding our inventories and financing our customers. So financing is the availability is fantastic and the rates are exceptional.
Mike Jackson, the chairman and CEO of AutoNation. Of course, you've got 250 auto dealers across 15 states really concentrated in the Sunshine Economy in Florida and Texas and California. What kind of growth rates are you anticipating really out of the state of Florida? What is Florida providing AutoNation that perhaps you're not seeing in other parts of your business?
Tom, to be honest, if we had a sunshine strategy, so we got clobbered during the downturn because California, Nevada, Arizona, and Florida all were heavily housing dependent. And I would say the recovery now in those states, because they went down more, is stronger than the rest of the country. And we've really seen a inflection point in housing where we had a period where there was no reason to build a house because by the time you took your construction cost, people could buy something that existed for far less. Within the last year, 2013, that switched where housing values have recovered to the point where new construction can resume. This is very beneficial to a state like Florida in that it really gives people confidence, again, about the future because they know their house is fundamentally worth what they owe for it. And, of course, the number of jobs that come with the resumption of construction. And if I look at Miami, you just drive through Miami and stop by the permitting office and see that there's 80-some major products in the pipeline waiting to come out of the ground. It gives you a lot of optimism about the Sunshine State for the next few years.
Mike Jackson is the chairman and the CEO of AutoNation based in Fort Lauderdale. Mike, Happy New Year. Thanks for your comments on the Sunshine Economy. And still to come, we'll build upon his comments. Is the real estate bubble inflating again?
We all must never lose sight of the fact that property development and real estate is a cyclical business.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson.
One, two, three.
As 2013 was coming to a close, shovels were turning the first dirt for what will be the first condominium building in downtown Miami since the real estate bust 5 years ago. Centro is what the building is called. Harvey Hernandez is the chairman of the group behind it, New Guard Development.
It represents the trend that we're going to be seeing in the next few years. The trend is a lot more residents coming to the urban centers close to where they work, right? Where they have the transportation hubs, the entertainment hubs, the culture, the parks. So that's the trend.
New Guard Development Group thinks the trend does not necessarily include on-site parking, though. It won't. Instead of a parking garage, Centro will have a car-sharing program on-site. And the demand? Well, three-quarters of the 352 condominiums are under contract already. That kind of sales activity at Centro and other developments, as well as existing housing, has fueled familiar worries about another real estate bubble in our region. Stephen Owens knows the talk well. He's the head of U.S. operations in Miami for the Hong Kong-based Swire Properties.
Well, bubble is a term it's often used. It seems to surface anytime there is a rather quick response in terms of new supply coming. I think it's a term that's a bit overused and not always relevant. I think one of the things you have to look at is what is on the demand side. And it's really the balance between the demand and the supply that is relevant. It's not how many new units might be coming.
Some of those are driven by you, by Swire Properties, and certainly the Brickell Center. Over 800 new residential units. The Related Companies has announced over 1,000 units. That's all just in one area in Brickell, let alone the condominium development that we're seeing on the waterfront side, for instance. So walk us through what you're seeing on the demand side that could perhaps justify some of the building, not only that Swire has undertaken, but some of your colleagues in this business.
Well, actually, our data suggests there's about 4,000 units in the greater Brickell area that have been announced or pre-selling or actually under construction. On the demand side, I think you have to look a little bit back to the last 4 or 5 years. This is well documented, but realistically, we had 14,000 units in the urban area. And out of that, we're down to less than 700 units remaining in the hands of the original sellers. And at the same time, we've seen not only that absorption of that product, but some of those units that were bought by investors have also been resold. Prices have continued to move up in a healthy way. Some would argue we're just now at the 2007-2008 levels. So what we've accomplished, which many people point to as significant and a potential reference to your bubble, is actually just getting back to where we were. I think on the demand side, we have to look at really where is the demand coming from. And what is the basis of it? And 2 points there, really. The absorption that we talk about has really occurred absent any local financing from the traditional U.S. banks. These are cash buyers. These are predominantly foreign buyers. Our tracking shows us about 82% foreign buyers. I think the second part of it is really, where is Miami relative to international valuation? And certainly if we look at what you can buy in Miami today, even at these prices, versus many places in the world, Miami is extremely favorable buy. I mean, New York, for example, now has a new product approaching $4,000 a square foot. Hong Kong and London are $10,000. We're not New York. We're not London or Hong Kong. We're a second-tier international city. But by comparison, to buy in Caracas, which some people say is the third most dangerous city in the world, and you pay $300 more a square foot than Miami, I think that's a relevant point.
Some concern that while the cash buyer has helped reinflate prices and helped support Miami real estate and South Florida real estate, that can be a fickle buyer. They can go away pretty quickly. Do you share that concern?
I think that is that can be a relevant argument. And I think we always have to be a little bit cautious about it. But I think it's really no different than the U.S. buyer, who historically, when we were more dependent on that market, was so reactive to interest rates. If interest rates jumped up half a point or three quarters of a point, suddenly the market was dry. So I don't see the sensitivity of the Latin buyer being more of a risk than what we saw with interest rate buyers and high leveraged purchasers dependent on U.S. mortgages.
A lot of hedge funds, investment funds, even some pension funds have gotten involved in real estate to absorb the supply in the Florida market, but also nationally. Is that a concern, as those time frames for those institutional buyers tend to be 2, 3, maybe 4 years, as we're 18 or 24 months into the cycle, that perhaps we're getting closer to the end of those unnatural buyers in a residential market?
I would argue that that's actually been healthy. The types of buyers that you're referring to, yes, have become active, partly driven by the fact there's so few opportunities elsewhere, so it was alternative investing. Secondly, though, I think in most cases they probably have done reasonably well. And so as another participant in the greater Miami story or South Florida story, I think they're valuable, because if they have a good experience, they're likely to reposition that money. Yes, they may turn it over within the timelines of their particular funds, but where else are they going to go? And if they've had a good experience here, they're likely to stay. And the amount of capital that is interested in Miami is much more significant than most people appreciate.
The investment that you're making in Brickell City Center, south of the Miami River, it's a hotel development, it's a retail development, it is a residential condominium development, and some office-based development. You've seen a number of cycles in the South Florida real estate market. What gives you the comfort for that billion-dollar investment, and where do you sense this market is in the normal cycle for South Florida real estate?
Well, in terms of the comfort level, I think part of it has to do with our ability to assemble a major site. We're now just short of 12 acres in the heart of the city, and in our view, the most preferred part of the urban area in terms of where it is at the moment and in terms of the quality of the development that we wish to do. We were able to do that because of the downturn. Without the most significant recession in my lifetime, and arguably the most significant one since the Great Depression, we would not have been able to assemble the site. So it always starts with the land and our business. The second part of it is that we're in at a very favorable price. And the third thing is that the magnitude of what we've been able to assemble allows us to take a view on a different type of development. This is not a one-off of office, hotel, or condominium. It is a collection of uses and elements. This is really one of the things that Swire has focused on in the last 25 years, and that is to really concentrate on large mixed-use projects of scale.
I want you to leave Brickell for a moment and look broader across the region. You've seen a number of real estate cycles here in South Florida and in the United States. Where do you think we are in this current real estate cycle for real estate development in the business that Swire is involved with?
Well, I think if you look at the state of Florida as a bigger parameter, I think we're still in the early stages of recovery. In terms of here in South Florida, I think we're a little bit further advanced, in particular on the retail and residential side, but not so much. And I think that there's a question mark that the future will tell us the answer to as to how much of this announced residential development, in fact, is built. I think a good bit of it will go forward. But there's a dynamic at work here that I don't think many appreciate, and that is costs are going up more rapidly than selling values. We're all surprised at the cost increase in the construction industry.
What's been driving that, Steve?
Well, It's a good question. I think some of it is a capacity question on the construction industry side. We can't lose sight of the fact that 30% of those that worked in the construction industry in 2007 are no longer around. I think there's a capacity question in on the material side, whether it's concrete plants or drywall manufacturing. And then there's the labor side of it.
Steve Owens is president of Swire Properties. Now, one example of the higher costs property developers are experiencing is concrete, a necessity ingredient for any high-rise condo, hotel, or office building. And owners say the concrete prices were up 3% nationally last year, but jumped 10% in South Florida. Still to come, Spirit Airlines stock took off in 2013, more than doubling in price. So what's next for the low-cost, no-frills carrier from Miramar? This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Staring at the sun, the year ahead for South Florida. Check baggage fee. Check. Carry-on baggage fee. Check. Having an airport agent print your boarding pass. Check. All will cost you extra if you fly Spirit Airlines. But those fees and just a large demand for its low-cost fares helped the carrier have a record 2013. Ben Baldanz is the CEO of Spirit Airlines, and he's back on the Sunshine Economy. Ben, congratulations on the year that was. 2014 will continue that growth, you anticipate?
Well, thank you very much, Tom. It's great to be with you. And yes, we plan to grow another about 16% this year and about 7% right here in South Florida. So we continue to grow.
I want to ask you more about that. The northern part of the country is dealing with some snow and ultra-cold weather. What about weather delays that Spirit is experiencing here as we kind of get back to work for 2014?
Well, like the whole industry, we're affected when cities like Chicago and New York and Boston get hit with very, very bad weather. But we're a little smaller company, and so we don't have as large an operation in some of those cities as some others. So we're able to, through good flexibility, usually handle most of it. We took some cancellations that mm-hmm. we don't like to have to take, of course. But overall, we've been able to fly through it pretty well.
What's the next fee that you're considering?
Well, first of all, we don't use that word at Spirit. We think about them as options, not as fees, because, you know, when you go out to dinner and you don't think about it as a fee to get coffee after dinner, right? It's just a price for the extra thing you
buy. What's the next cost
right?
or price that you're thinking about? Your a la carte pricing.
Well, you know, what we're thinking now is how we can possibly be a little smarter about the way we price some things, that we think we could offer lower baggage fees, for example, more often if we could charge higher bag fees at certain peak times and start to put some more demand-based pricing into baggage fees, for example.
So similar to what the I-95 express lanes do, the worse the traffic, the higher cost to the express lane. You're thinking about doing possibly the same for baggage fees.
Possibly the same, and that's the same as consumers have seen for many, many years with ticket prices, of course.
Well, sure. If demand is up, prices tend to be able to go up.
And we think applying that logic to things like baggage fees or seat assignment fees could raise revenue, but also ultimately result in lower baggage fees or seat fees for many, many customers, higher for some during peak periods.
How would that work, though? If the plane is full, would you have higher baggage fees?
It'd be more a function of the demand for the travel time. So, for example, gotcha. Maybe at Christmas time, a bag might be a little more than in an off-peak time. But what that would do is for most days of the year, it would mean that those charges would be the same or lower.
You tried to get people maybe that would travel in the middle of the week as opposed to a Monday morning flight and a Friday morning flight back or a Sunday night flight back.
That's right. The other thing we try to do is we try to find things that people want to buy. And so it's not really a fee if you're going to buy your hotel or you're going to buy a rental car anyway, but if you can buy it through Spirit and we can earn a commission on that sale, that gives us incremental revenues that we can use to then lower your ticket price even further. So we like that.
You've got one less competitor in the new year, American Airlines and U.S. Airways combining, consolidating their operations. Those, of course, are major carriers. The legacy carriers is what the industry term is. You're an ultra-low-cost carrier. But what does one less competitor on the price board mean for you?
Well, we see it as a positive trend in terms of industry economic stability. If you go back a few years ago in 2008, the industry lost about $10 billion That's with a B.
Yeah. Of course, that was during the Great Recession, too.
Well, that's true, and with very high fuel prices. In 2012, fuel prices for the full year were about the same as in 2008, but as an industry, the airline industry made about 4%. And the difference was the consolidations that started with Delta and Northwest, yep, and then United, Continental, Air Trans Southwest, and now American U.S. Airways is sort of a continuing that trend. And that's a trend that's been generally really positive for industry stability. And it's been very positive for Spirit Airlines, because what it's done is it's created overall higher fares and less service in the legacy model, which creates more growth opportunity for a carrier like Spirit to come into places that have been, that have not been flown by those carriers, or they're not, no longer being flown by those carriers, and offer a real low fare alternative.
What's the one market you want to fly to in 2014 that you're not in now?
Well, I can't say that because we haven't announced it yet, but I can tell you we'd like to be bigger almost everywhere.
Is it in the U.S.?
Yeah, the U.S. is a great place for us right now, again, because generally in the U.S., fares are higher for consumers and service options are more limited. And so by offering that low fare alternative, it creates great growth opportunity for Spirit Airlines.
It's not a fee if you are willing to pay for it, according to Ben Baldanza, the CEO of Spirit Airlines, with us here on the Sunshine Economy. Still to come, a new year brings the same challenges of searching for work in the Sunshine Economy.
This is a new year. Maybe the first quarter will bring some more hiring opportunities that weren't around in 2013.
My outlook is still very positive. I believe, you know, there's something out there for me. I just haven't come across it yet.
This is 91.3 WLRN and...
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. 2013 was a great year for the job market, at least statistically. Florida's official statewide unemployment rate fell from 8% to below 6.5%. There were 205,000 more people employed in Florida in November compared to last January, more than 10,000 of those in South Florida. But there are 32,000 fewer people included in the Florida labor force today compared to a year ago.
My name is Jay Pellis. I'm from Coral Springs. I've been unemployed for about a year and a half. So I've been looking for work. I hope to be starting a position as a part-time GED instructor. That will be a good placeholder. Perhaps I'll be able to find something full-time with them.
That was Jay when we spoke with him back in September. He was successful in getting the part-time job with a nonprofit teaching GED prep classes to young adults who had left the foster care system but had not graduated from high school. As the new year begins, he's still employed, underemployed, and looking for more work.
I'm trying to follow the general optimism of everybody that 2014 will be better than 2013. And most of the people that I toasted with said that 2013 was just not a good year. So I'm trying to ride in on the general optimism and hope that that'll last me until I can find something more permanent. The emotions are mixed in that I love the work I do. Were this a full-time job, I would feel that I've entered pre-retirement because it's work that I enjoy. But basically, it's go to work and then come home and look for work. That's the nature of the underemployed. And it's been tough during the holidays. I mean, all the car commercials. I mean, my wife is driving a car with almost 200,000 miles. She drives to Juneau Beach from Coral Springs every day. So I would love to be able to put her in a car that's a little more, I've got more confidence behind. I would love to have taken advantage of some of the sales over the Christmas break, but there were a few holiday gifts this year. I mean, I come from the old school of, you know, you find a job with an organization or a corporation and you stay there for a while and you end up with whatever benefits they may offer long term. But right now, if I can put together two or three jobs that total a full-time salary, that's what I may be looking at. And as far as a career, I don't know. If I can find a niche that I can stay at for a while and call that a career, that would be fine. If I have to bounce around from part-time to part-time, that may be the nature of the beast. Certainly not my first choice. it's all the same thing. Apply online. You get the emails of job openings that somehow were sent out at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then somehow 3 or 4 or 5 days later, at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's an email back that says you know, thank you, but no thank you. New Year's Eve at 11:55, I got an email, a thank you, but no thank you email. So everything is automated. The human touch is limited. I, as everybody else, still persevere and type the cover letter, do the attachments, send the email, and keep the fingers crossed. I don't know that the next steps are any different than the previous steps, except hopefully keep an eye on whatever trends may be out there in new businesses that may be moving to South Florida. I don't know that there are a tremendous amount, but this is a new year. Maybe the first quarter will bring some more hiring opportunities that weren't around in 2013.
That's Jay Pellis, one of the underemployed in the Sunshine Economy. When we focused on the job market back in September, he wasn't the only one we met.
Sal Clemente, and I live in Oakland Park, Florida, and I have been looking for full-time, solid, steady employment to where I can enjoy getting up in the morning and going to work for, it'll be coming up on 3 years in October.
Another 4 months have gone by. Sal continues to get up in the morning, but still no luck in finding work.
2014, I'm hoping to actually have a job. And at this point, it's not even a career. I want a job. I want an income. I want to be able to keep a roof over my head and food in my mouth at this point. Challenges are just getting a phone call or an interview. You know, it's been silly. I'm a pretty smart person, I think. I'm pretty marketable. I know a lot that I can utilize and be an asset to others. But, you know, apparently whatever's being judged based on what they see on paper, you know, is been a limitation. And I have rewritten my resume probably once a week over the last, you know, 20 weeks. My emotions? I'm a pretty outgoing guy. I'm very in your face, very energetic, very enthusiastic, and very optimistic and positive, and all of those incredible words that you can think of, those amazing adjectives. But this is starting to get depressing. This is starting to get frustrating. This is starting to anger. And the list goes on there too. You know, you try and avoid things like that, though. You try and avoid the negative. You try and avoid, you know, I think maintaining a positive attitude and maintaining an enthusiastic, outgoing energy has been key for me. Now benefits are cut off for me. You know, the benefits that I was able to obtain, you know, it helped a little bit. You know, it put food in my house. It paid, you know, one or two of the bills, so, you know, my roommate wasn't carrying the full burden, and now there's nothing. So, you know, I can't imagine what I can do differently. You know, I mean, I've done the online search, I've done the in-person search, I've, you know, printed off the cover letter and a resume and sent it via U.S. snail mail. I have, you know, hand-delivered. You know, you hear of a job and, you know, you press something really fast, you put on very decent clothes and make yourself very presentable, you print out a very nice resume on great paper, you go, you hand deliver, you hear all these, oh my gosh, that's so great, I'm so glad you were able to, like, take the initiative, and hear nothing. My outlook is still very positive. I believe, you know, there's something out there for me, I just haven't come across it yet. I want to work. You know, if I have to learn something new, I have to learn something new. I want to work.
Sal Clemente, one of the thousands looking for work in South Florida as the year begins. Like most of us, hoping and working to make 2014 shine a little brighter. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Thanks for listening.